how do we distribute that data out to the care navigators, out to the providers, out to the individuals that are actually going to make it actionable beyond just a dashboard?
Welcome to our podcast, Overcoming Management and Interoperability Challenges for Aggregating and Managing Data During and Post-Pandemic, sponsored by IMO. I'm Patty Enrado with HIMSS, and I'm with Keith Parker, Chief Information Officer at HealthCurrent, and Dale Sanders, Chief Strategy Officer at IMO. Welcome, Keith and Dale.
Morning.
Hi, Patty. Hi, Keith. Great to be here.
Great, and thanks for both of you being here. COVID-19 greatly impacted healthcare organizations that aggregate, manage, and analyze vast amounts of clinical data. That includes health information exchanges, organizations that handle clinical data registries, public health systems, and data and analytics technology partners. All of these stakeholders had to quickly stand up and support telehealth and try to manage great volumes of data coming from not only traditional channels, but new and many times disparate sources. We had so many new use cases evolving, from identifying COVID-19 patients for treatment and clinical trials to analyzing and disseminating patient data as vaccines started rolling out. So these organizations are still trying to manage all that data, all the while making sure that relevant, accurate information gets to the right stakeholders in a timely manner to support patient care and population health. So in this podcast, we're going to look at how these challenges impacted Keith's and Dale's organizations and how they leverage technology to address those pain points in order to get that complete picture of the patient and populations of patients to drive better outcomes. So Keith and Dale, let's dive right into the discussion. So my first question is, how has COVID-19 impacted the ability of data aggregators to create a complete, accurate picture of the patient to support population health initiatives? So Keith, how about you?
I would start off with the pandemic. COVID-19 actually supported in identifying the need for data. And I start there because we were already as a health information exchange / data manager. And I always add in the data manager because it's all about managing data and making sure that it's standardized and usable. What the pandemic did was actually highlight where we had gaps. It highlighted where we had a lack of standards or standards being applied, which actually impacted the usability of the data. Here in Arizona, we're already moving forward with how we work with our public health. So this just spurred that relationship to be able to get more data. What it really impacted was early on, there was a scene, and I'm talking back or referring back to what I mentioned for my gap, is as our Department of Health started receiving data, they started identifying gaps. Some of the early gaps were how to match patients, patients' ethnicity, age, certain types of demographics. And as the health information exchange, we're actually able to develop data extracts out of our database to support and augment the data that our Department of Health was receiving. So from a public health perspective, having lots or vast amounts of data really isn't the answer. It's having the right amount of data that can be used for what you're looking at. So it's quality as well as completeness of data.
Great, Dale.
Keith touched on it here. I think what I observed with COVID, and by the way, during COVID, I was chief technology officer at Health Catalyst. Since then, I've transitioned to IMO. Health Catalyst is a data aggregator analytics platform and an HIE company. So from that perspective, what I saw was a breakdown and a pretty significant flaw in the US healthcare system in that there's a division between public health, acute care, population health, and ambulatory clinics. We have a hard enough time sharing data between hospitals and clinics, right? But what really COVID put a spotlight on was this complete gap and separation between public health and population health. You know, the hospitals and clinics that are struggling with population health, COVID was essentially a population health issue. It was an infectious disease, but it was a population health issue. I had the privilege of serving as CIO for the National Health System of the Cayman Islands a few years ago. And that exposed me to international healthcare in a way that I'd never seen before. For instance, the director of public health for the country of the Cayman Islands sat on the executive team for the healthcare delivery system. We didn't make any distinction between population health and public health. And I think the organizational and cultural differences that we have in the US around that just cascaded down into data problems. Last comment on that, Health Catalyst has a national repository of data in a repository called Touchstone. And we were, I think, the first nationwide COVID registry. we'd been pulling data on somewhere around 90 to 100 million patients at that time from every EHR in the country using it for analytics. And what was stunning when we really looked at that was how poorly standardized our vocabulary and terminology is. You know, things like SNOMED, even the use of consistent use of ICDs, and almost no widespread use of LOINC or RxNorm. So our ability to understand the situation at the national level was greatly impacted by the lack of consistent, comprehensive, and widespread use of standard terminology. And so what we're seeing, I think, in the country is, and I bet Keith sees this day in and day out, standard terminology and use of vocabulary is generally not used unless you're being reimbursed for it. But we need those standard terms and terminology for situational awareness in these pandemics and population health and public health.
You know, there's a point there, Dale, if I could, because you said something that I think is extremely critical here, and that was around your work overseas. So I spent some time as a senior public health official with the State Department working overseas.
Ah.
When I worked overseas, it was a systems approach. It wasn't a siloed approach. Here in the U.S., our cultural approach, we try to speak of it in terms of a system, our state, our country, but we silo it with EHR systems, health information technology, and how standards are being applied. And then we silo it with public health, population health, different things that we want to do. The data does not care if it's being used for fill in the blank.
Great. So my second question is, you know, where were the failures and weaknesses in the process or flow of collecting, aggregating, sharing, and analyzing data? I know we started talking about these silos. So Dale, can you walk us through what some of those failures or weaknesses were or are?
It came down to a data rights issue for a lot of the organizations, right? We've never really had the need to share data across these boundaries. You know, that Keith was talking about, data knows no boundaries, but we didn't have the administrative, the contractual, even the cultural relationships to share data across these organizations that really needed to start sharing data more ubiquitously. So it was a combination of HIPAA initially, but then we got some waivers, you know, from OCR that enabled data sharing across some of these boundaries thanks to those HIPAA relaxations. But there were also, and I witnessed this with our HIE, traditionally the HIEs haven't used data to the effect that we needed to use it in COVID. So there weren't the relationships with the healthcare providers, for example, for the secondary use of data in the way that we needed to use it for COVID. Sometimes it was a data rights issue between the HIE and the clients that were participating in the HIEs, but sometimes it was a cultural and relationship issue as well.
The interesting thing, or my initial thought on that, is that's regionally based or state based, but it needs to be addressed nationally through policy as well, because we shouldn't have, if you look at referral patterns don't really care what state you're in.
Yeah.
If I live in the Sierra Nevadas, I'm going to fall over into Loma Linda. I'm going to fall over into California from the Nevada side, because that's where the care patterns follow. You know, depending on where I'm at in the Sierra Nevadas, I might fall into Reno. If I'm on the border of Arizona and California, same thing. I might fall into one of the sites on the Arizona side. But the patients, from a legislative perspective, they just want care. Yeah. And the data needs to follow them as well. So some states have done a better job, is my opinion, as far as opening up that culture to a culture of data sharing. Other states have not. So for me, it really comes down to, it's a national issue that's being addressed locally, and it needs to be reversed. We need to address this nationally. 42 CFR Part 2, protected data and substance abuse is a great example.
Yeah.
Where the national, the statutes on that don't align with HIPAA. And creates in conflicts a lot of states and how they apply consent, how they can share data. And these are patient safety issues. These are issues that deal with how do you get to the data to the right places to be able to support better treatment.
So I was participating with this national volunteer coalition in COVID to just trying to get our hands on data and the situation. And what I saw there was very interesting, actually. We couldn't go to a single point of contact that represented all of the HIEs and formulate sort of a national data strategy around the role that HIE should play in COVID, right? So there was no place that we could go. There was a single point of contact that would say, look, this is what we need to do, and this is how we need to collect data and interact with HIEs. We had to go region by region by region to figure out what the data rights were and what the cultural relationships were. We ended up going to these national repositories that Cerner, Epic, Health Catalyst, and Allscripts had, mostly because we didn't know where to start with HIEs.
That's a huge gap and something that we need to take care of.
Yeah.
Here in Arizona, being on this trajectory where we have a good relationship with the state, and I think this is going to be addressed down the line, but it's not just how do you aggregate the data, how do you use the data? And this is where HIEs can really support that last mile. How do we actually distribute the data? So if we aggregate it and we get it to our Department of Health and Human Services to be able to use that data, how do we actually get that data dispersed out to the emergency departments to know that I'm presenting with something to where I just tested positive?
Yeah.
How do we get that out to the physician for their patient panel to know that their most at-risk patients may have or may not have received an immunization, or they are or are not testing positive? What are those controls that are being put in place? It's not just about looking at this through a public health or a population health lens, but through a actionable lens. And how do we get the data down to those points of care as well? And that's where HIEs, at least in my mind, can really come in, because speaking from Health Current's perspective, we've gone to great lengths to make sure that the data can be distributed in accordance with federal and state statute. So we're following HIPAA, we're following 42 CFR Part 2.
Yeah.
But how do we distribute that data out to the care navigators, out to the providers, out to the individuals that are actually going to make it actionable beyond just a dashboard on a public health website?
Interesting. I have a question, Patty. Can I ask Keith a couple of questions?
Oh, absolutely.
I have two questions. One is the availability of lab and testing data and the data flowing through the HIEs from the national labs, for example, like Quest and LabCorp, et cetera. And then the other is, and maybe this is the first question I'd love to hear your response to. What I saw in working with the various HIEs trying to figure out what to do during COVID was an inconsistent ability between the HIEs to make analytic sense of the data passing through the HIE. So some of the HIEs were more about the transaction, individual messages, less about the aggregation of data in those messages to understand the situation. What do you think about that, Keith? As a CIO of an HIE, what are your thoughts about that?
So I think there's some crossover there. So some HIEs like analytics. We like analytics from the perspective of quality initiatives and data quality.
Yeah.
So we knew early on we were measuring from what we were seeing going through our Department of Health, what the volumes were and what the percentage of COVID testing was going through our system. So when we first started, we were at approximately 65 to 70% of all tests were going through our system. We found that a big gap there was we had a great relationship with one of our national labs, and we had another relationship that wasn't as great with another national lab. And the market's really divided between those two, and, you know, Quest and LabCorp. Just everybody knows who the big players are.
Yeah.
With Sonora Quest, we've always had a great relationship with LabCorp. Their interpretation of CLIA and how data needs to flow, in my opinion, prohibits some of the connectivity, which is fine. We all need to interpret statute and these rules differently, and we need to apply it in accordance with our organizations. We came to agreements with a LabCorp where we actually took a harder path of giving every provider to authorize that data to flow to us as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to do it individually rather than from larger bulk agreements from the other side. So it's really how we interpret things such as CLIA as well. And we went from 65 to 70 to 80, 85, 90, you know, to higher percentages of those lab tests going through. Now, the bigger issue with us was knowing the volumes is just a piece of it.
Right.
Keeping up with the compendiums, keeping up with the actual, all the changes in the line codes was the other piece. We had to maintain those relationships. We've got almost a full-time FTE that maintains all those codes.
Yeah.
So if we see a change, we have to write code to where it'll error out if there's changes or things come across. Because the volumes are so great, as you know, how do you identify when something's changed in those coded elements embedded in an HL7 or an XML document? So we had to find ways to do that.
You're bringing up another point, and that is, so the relationship between the labs, the national labs, and public health, population health, right? The technical and the administrative relationship between those entities has to improve, right? And the other thing is, the going back to the terminology, there was almost no widespread use of the LOINC codes that we needed for orders and results. So there was a big gap in understanding actually what was being ordered and the results that were coming back, because as a nation, we're just not widely embracing the use of LOINC. I mean, it's what I saw in Touchstone is somewhere around maybe 20% at most, 20% of the results were coming back with LOINC codes associated with them. So 80% of them were kind of guesswork.
Yeah, and we've actually had programs in place for a number of years now to where we're looking at the quality and consistency of the specific data elements coming across. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at it, and it's what I refer to as starting out foundationally, right?
Yeah.
First name, last name, date of birth, gender, race, ethnicity. We're looking at LOINC coding. What are the percentages that we're actually receiving? Where are the gaps? How do we actually increase them? So we've actually taken a posture of how do we engage with our data sources, that more collaborative. Here in Arizona, from Health Current's perspective, it's a collaborative approach. Because just having standards out there, you have so many to choose from. I oftentimes say Deming and Jarn are rolling over in their graves from two different perspectives. One, everybody embraces standards. Two, they embrace the standard that they like.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We're standardized. Just ask me. This is what we've done to be able to implement how we define the standard, which is exactly opposite of where we need to be nationally. We need to have those standards well-defined. We need to be able to actually find ways to push our data sources and EMR vendors and HIT vendors to apply those standards within the back end of their system as well. Not now how they see it, but how they need to be accepted nationally.
Now you're prompting even more thoughts, which is national patient identifier. And FHIR is not going to be the holy grail that we all think it is if we don't implement it consistently. FHIR is going to essentially be another problem with standards if we're not better about consistently implementing the way FHIR has been deployed. And then, of course, the lack of a national patient identifier, big, big issue in really understanding the situation of COVID.
From a national patient identifier, we haven't even set standards to where we want individuals to be within this margin of accuracy. Here's where it's acceptable, because we're going to have error. How do we identify that error? And then how do we correct it? And it's not just patient matching, it's patient overlay issues. Mm-hmm. It's how do we actually apply patient identifiers at the technology level? Mm-hmm. And then how do we actually bring them into large aggregation systems?
Going back to international work, right? There's not an international country that I've worked with that doesn't have a national patient identifier. I think we're the only developed country that doesn't have that. And as you talked about, Keith, the thresholds for matching are one problem, but it's also, what are the benchmarks for duplicates, right? Yep. What do we think is an acceptable standard for duplicates? Is it 1%? I mean, from personal experience, sometimes those numbers are as high as 10 and 20%, and that's got all sorts of safety issues. So anyway, Patty, sorry to take off on this. Thanks for letting us run with some of the questions, friend. Thank you.
No, I love the way that this conversation is flowing, but I will wrangle it back to some of my other questions. So can you talk about the challenges and approach to collecting vaccine data?
Public health and population health. It's that distinction between the two, really. We just didn't have the infrastructure for it. There's a gap between public health data, right, where the vaccine data was essentially flowing up to public health, and that was not making it back to electronic health records for the most part, and vice versa, right?
Here in Arizona, we actually hit it from two different fronts, and this is where I feel very lucky to work with an executive team that has some just extraordinary individuals when it comes to policy. They tackled it from the policy perspective, getting legislative changes through our legislature to get emergency legislation signed by our governor so we could start getting the data back from Department of Health, since they were the source of truth, so we can use it to distribute is the end goal for that.
Right.
But what we were seeing was, holy cow, approximately 15% of COVID immunizations were coming through our system. Now, I would equate that to Those are the immunizations that were being given in the hospitals that were being given. So the data collection was at the Cerner, the Epic, the MedAtac, at those EMRs that we're connected to, not at the large immunization sites. What we're doing now is we're actually, through some of the legislation that we're getting moved through and working with our Department of Health, we're actually working on daily data dumps from our Department of Health, their immunization registry or ACES, into our environment. So we can then leverage the HIE from a distributive perspective and how that data is going to be used downstream by providers, so we can start populating our providers' systems as well.
What I observed across the states is it's almost a county by county process.
Yep.
And variable. If the county's public health department has a relationship with the care provider, then there might be some data exchange. So for instance, in Utah, we're pretty well known for our health information exchange and interoperability and that kind of thing. My primary care provider still doesn't know if I've been vaccinated or not, but the Salt Lake County Health Department does, right? So again, it's that gap between public health and population health. I'm going to keep going back to that. Nationally, culturally, from a policy standpoint, we have to close that gap between the two. They are not the distinct entities that we treat them, right? From a data or an organizational execution perspective.
I would add, from a data or a technical perspective, a lot of time those standards are set by CDC. CDC typically sets the standards based on an HL7 VXU, how that data is coming across. A lot of environments send the data. What we're seeing from some of our larger data sources is we're receiving it in a CCD or in an XML. So there's a standard disconnect as well. So there's interesting things that we also have to address as we're moving forward. And that's, how do we align standards and how do we align those interoperability, those connections, or the formatting, how the data is formatted, how it's moved as well. And it goes back to loin codes are a great one. If we have loin codes out there, but I think one of the numbers you put out there was 20% are being used, or it's at a 20% rate. That really doesn't do us anywhere near.
No, it's where embarrassing.
I was at a conference a couple of years ago and they were talking about FHIR and how we're moving forward. And I asked them how they're going to integrate some of the older standards.
Right.
Well, nobody's on those. I'm like, you know, that's about 80, 90% of the business we do are those.
Absolutely.
Just because we roll out a new standard doesn't mean that it's picked up by all of the vendors and distributed nationally.
Yep.
I mean, we have to keep up with where we're at as a country as well.
And I actually think that that actually segues into my next question. You know, we've talked a lot about how this needs to be addressed, you know, on the policy level, but how can technology be leveraged or, you know, to resolve these issues? You know, how can health information exchanges, health IT, you know, technology partners, how can they resolve these issues, you know, outside of the policy that needs to be done? And what lessons were learned from having to address these challenges?
The first one that comes to my mind is, and I'm going to be a little, I think the word that's been kicked around locally is snarky on this one. We all say that we want to collaborate until it comes down to promoting our individual technology stack. We've got to learn how to build out those stacks so they are compatible. So we are following the same standards. Policy only gets us so far, but policy typically leaves gaps in how it's interpreted and then how it's applied from a technology perspective. Even with all the money that we pour into healthcare and healthcare technology, we still have individuals that approach it from, I'm trying to gain market share. I'm trying to get my technology stack out there. But I personally believe we should be promoting, how do we get a solution out there that we can all rally behind? And when I say a solution, I mean standards. Because oftentimes people ask me what I like for technology, and it's the technology that's applied from a standardized approach. Because all of them have similar backends, but we get so wrapped around, I'm an Epic shop or a Cerner shop or a MedAtac or a Health Catalyst or a NextGen, we lose sight of the details. And the details are, the data has to be aggregated and usable. What do I think we can do? Learn how to collaborate better. Learn how to say, you know, it's not about market share. It's about patient safety. It's about population health and supporting our environments and our patients and knocking down some of those silos. We spent years trying to integrate care. And at the same time we're integrating care, we're isolating and siloing the data. Just the opposite of what we're trying to do from a care perspective. because too often systems are approaching SDOH as a separate data stream. They're approaching advanced directives, not from a systemic or integrated perspective, but in a separate document registry that may or may not have access to that you have to access separately. We're isolating 42 CFR Part 2 or substance abuse rather than figuring out ways to be able to layer consent so it's all in the same pool and usable by our providers. Because if I present to a provider and I have a substance abuse issue, I have some chronic health issues, I have some social determinants of health or other needs, that provider and that patient don't want to look in five different places. They want to be able to receive that data aggregated and make it usable at the point of care.
Let's see. Well, it's always follow the money, right? And generally speaking, in healthcare, it doesn't pay yet to collaborate. It pays to be proprietary and it pays to be closed. I'm going to reflect back on my time in the military and the Air Force as a command, control, communications, and intelligence officer. There's a reason that data flows so seamlessly from the battlefield to the AWACS to the regional command center to the national command centers for status and situational awareness. And the reason it flows like that is those information systems that are procured with those dollars have to follow very rigorous standards for interoperability. And we learned this the hard way in Vietnam and then and oddly in Grenada, small way, then later on in Panama. By the time the Middle East wars showed up, the procurement of information systems in the military had evolved to the point that allowed for amazing interoperability in incredibly complex and critical environments. What we never do in healthcare is procure information systems like EHRs from a rigorous standards and interoperability perspective. We never force the vendors to follow standards in a way that makes sure that we can interoperate and share data across systems. So as Keith touched on, you know, we still treat SDOH as this sort of new thing, this new data stream, but it's not, right? It's just a natural attribute extension of the patient that we're trying to understand. And if you look at the evolution of EHRs and data models, they started off as encounter-centric. It was about a clinical encounter. And literally, if you peel apart the data model of modern EHRs, they're encounter-centric. They're not patient-centric. So it's an encounter at the middle of the data model, and then you hang attributes of the encounter off of that central table, right? But what we need to do is flip that. The patient has to be the center of the data model. Then it's easy to hang attributes off of that. Unfortunately, FHIR is still essentially, you know, from the legacy, it's a little bit of an encounter-centric data model. It's not truly patient-centric yet. So I'm encouraged by the collaboration that's occurring between FHIR and OMOP. That's going to be a more robust data model. And SDOH and other attributes about a patient have a higher probability of fitting into that hybrid data model more elegantly.
Great. Well, thanks, Dale. And I think what you said actually is a good way to, you know, wrap up this podcast. You know, not to be think that this is a really easy sort of sum up of all the things that you said, but it sounds like, you know, we have to, as an industry, have a real commitment to true collaboration and true standardization. And if we think about the patient being in the center, that hopefully that gets us to move forward. So thank you so much for your time, Keith and Dale. It's been a great conversation, sponsored by IMO.
Thank you. And Patty, thank you.
Yep, would agree.